Okay, I believe everybody is on the screen that's supposed to be here. We'll do a mic check first before we start to make sure everybody can hear everybody else. Justice Kern.
Yes.
Okay, Justice Jensen.
Yes.
Justice Devaney.
Yes.
Justice Severson.
Yes.
Mr. Haig.
Yes.
Mr. Kozinka.
Yes.
Mr. Brentrow.
Yes, Judge.
Good. Okay. This is the time and the place set in the matter of Bradley Tamert, MD, appellant versus Alicia Ferguson, appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Mark Haig, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellees, we have Mr. Robert Terzinka and Mr. Daniel Brentrow, also attorneys from Sioux Falls. I understand, Mr. Terzinka, you'll be presenting this morning?
That is correct, Judge.
Okay. And Justice Salter has disqualified himself on this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable Glenn Severson, a retired justice of this court, to sit in Justice Salter's place. With that, Mr. Hay, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. The issue before this court is whether Dr. Thamer should be compelled to produce the redacted medical records of hundreds of former patients to the plaintiff and her counsel to allow plaintiff to test the credibility as to his standard of practice in obtaining informed consent from his surgical patients. Your Honors, I would say that I believe this is one of the most important issues that I've ever argued before this court. Because the real issue that's before this court is what protection, if any, do we provide to the very personal and very sensitive medical records of non-party plaintiffs, patients, excuse me. What we would ask the court to do is to further define its ruling in the WIF case and adopt a standard that limits production of non-party medical records to those cases like WIF, where the defendant physician has injected the issue of non-party medical records into an essential element of the case. And I believe, Your Honors, the importance of this issue is very well explained in the WIF dissent. One of the purposes of the physician-patient privilege is confidentiality, and that's an important factor that any patient has when they're talking to their doctor. But perhaps more importantly, as recognized in the WIF dissent, what we're trying to achieve with the physician-patient privilege is the free flow of information from a patient to his physician, free from any fear that what the patient tells the physician will later be disclosed in any form to someone else. And when we start creating exceptions to that privilege, we correspondingly reduce the patient's confidence in the security of those communications that he discloses to his physician. And that's not something we want to do as a public policy. The more we can define and limit the exception to that privilege, the greater the public good is served by giving patients more security when they talk to their physicians. Now, the majority opinion in WIF, I've read it 25 times, probably getting ready for this hearing, and it's well written, and it's a very legally rational decision when applied to the facts of that case. But WIF was a very different situation than what's before the court in this case. And because of those differences, WIF did not address one reality. And maybe with my medical history, I'm a little too close to this issue, but in a state like South Dakota, with its small population, no matter how many names and addresses and social security things that we redact from a patient's medical records, no matter how hard we try to redact those personal information, it's very likely that at least one, and probably many more, patients are going to be identified simply from the circumstances of their medical records. And it's a real possibility that there's no way to cure that when we produce those records to the plaintiff, because every patient can be identified, or most patients can be identified by their medical circumstances, even when their names aren't there, their social securities or whatnot. So,
Mr. Haig, if I can interrupt you, talking about sort of distinguishing WIP, I guess, is what I'm hearing from you. If we're not addressing this as a privilege issue, is it your suggestion that we address this as a scope of discovery issue under 26A or a protective order issue under 26C? Or how would you suggest, under your theory, that this court address it separate from privilege?
Your Honor, we believe that this is a privilege issue and should be addressed under the de novo standard. Obviously, if you move to Rule 26 and want to address it as a discovery standard, I think the standard is different, and it's an abuse of discretion standard. But we would ask the court to recognize that there needs to be some protection given to medical records, some protection that falls within that physician-patient privilege, even when those records are redacted.
Oh, so you're arguing again, you're arguing it under the privilege statute, not discovery statutes.
I think both Rule 26 and the privilege statutes provide protection. My foremost argument would be under the privilege statute. Can you hear me? I'm getting a message on my internet.
Yeah. Do you see any differences between the two statutes?
Between Rule 26 and the privilege statute?
Right.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think the privilege statute is much stronger. What the statute does is recognizes the physician. If you read WIF, you know, down to its bare bones, I think what it says is once you redact the names and other confidential information from the record, the patient ceases to be a patient and the record ceases to be a medical record. And our position is under the facts of WIF, that may have been correct because it was different facts, some circumstances that I hope to get to, but it didn't address one reality. And the reality, again, is that that statute is intended to protect people, patients, when they're talking to their physicians. It's intended to encourage people to freely discuss things with their physicians. And therefore, I think the statute, the privilege, has greater protection than Rule 26. And again, I do believe that the law is that if you're going to find under Rule 26 that we're protected, again, it's an abuse of discretion standard. But I believe that the privilege statute is a de novo review. And our primary argument is that this statute has to provide some protection to the patients.
So I don't want you to run out of time here, and I would like you to get, you suggested we refine the standard, and often the devil is in the details here. And I understand that the WIP request is a little different than this one. Do you have a suggestion to the court as to where that line is drawn? Is it a line that can be applied to all cases, or do we just look at it and the specific request on a case-by-case basis?
Your Honor, I believe, I mean, there's always going to be some discretion for the trial court, but I believe that the standard should be that the defendant physician should have injected other non-patient party medical records into an essential element of the case. That would limit the number of cases where we're unnecessarily disclosing non-patient medical records to other people. I think that would be the standard. And I think WIF followed that standard because in WIF, the defendant, through his expert, raised the issue and said, you know, I'd have to look at non-party patient records to see if the standard of care was violated.
So then how do you apply that standard to this case?
Well, first of all, in this case, there's a lot of differences. First of all, the plaintiffs want this information, in essence, to challenge the credibility of Dr. Thamer. And so Dr. Thamer does this procedure, and then a year later he gives his deposition, and he's asked, you know, do you remember what was discussed with the patient? And he said, I don't have a specific memory of my discussion with the patient regarding this preoperative appointment. And so what happened in this case was the plaintiff then said, well, since he doesn't remember, Dr. Thamer said, I have a general practice, though. When I do these types of procedures, I come in and explain to the patient, you know, we're going to go through the abdomen. There's a lot of blood vessels. There's a lot of nerves. It's a very major surgery. We need to be safe that we don't injure any of the organs, nerves, blood vessels. And we have that discussion, and I get the patient's informed consent. And so what the plaintiffs are asking for is some way to take all these other records and supposedly say, we're going to use these records in order to determine whether what Dr. Thamer testified to was his custom and practice with regard to obtaining informed consent is accurate. And so I don't believe that would rise to the level of where we would want to give no protection to non-party patient medical records and distribute them, because I will tell you, based on my experience in doing a lot of medical malpractice work, it's very difficult for a physician who treats, you know, tens of patients a day and then gets sued and then gives his deposition. In this case, it was actually shorter than in most, but it's very typical that a doctor will say, I don't have a specific memory of the specific conversation, because, you know, he's now 1,000 patients down the road. And so if you allow the discovery in this case, because Dr. Thamer says, I don't remember the specific discussion, but what I typically do is X, then you've opened it up in every case. Because in nearly every case, the patient or the plaintiff can create some way in which the doctor will say, you know, this is my standard practice, or this is the way I typically do it. And so at least the standard that I would suggest to the court would deal with essential elements, which would be not just using the records to impeach credibility, but actually where there's an essential element, like in WIF, where defendant's own physician said, in order to determine whether there was a violation of the standard of care, I need to look at these records. In this case, the plaintiff's attorneys really haven't articulated how they're going to use these records. And that's one of the difficulties in defending the case. It appears to me that they're saying, since Dr. Thamer said this is how he typically does it, we should be able to look at all these records and make sure that is, and then we can use them to impeach them. And it,
we have held that the privilege belongs to the patient, not to the doctor. So how can a doctor, by his answer, waive the privilege and open up the records under our privilege statute?
Well, what the WIF court said in that case was, I believe, was that once the information is redacted, it's the patient is no longer a patient, and therefore you don't need to waive the privilege. And I would ask the court to vary that just a little bit, because I hate to use the slogan, but or the same, but, you know, bad facts make bad law. And in WIF, it was a very narrow circumstance. It was, you know, the defendant's own doctor stands up and says, you can't tell if this guy's negligent unless you look at his complication history. And so the defendant is essentially saying, if you don't look at these records, there's no way you can prove he's negligent. And so they created the issue themselves. I don't believe we created the issue by saying this is my custom and practice, because again, in every case, if custom and practice is the standard for opening up other patient medical records, nearly every medical malpractice case is going to end with releasing all these records. And I think it, you know, I go back to this argument about, you know, patients want to know that their records are confidential. And I think if patients knew that the standard was becoming, hey, your records might be released in a case and you won't even know about it, but they're going to take your name and address off it, they wouldn't be very happy. And I do want to get on to one of the difficulties, Your Honor, with this particular case and what the plaintiff's attorneys apparently want to do with it. Now, in WIF, what they were going to do with the patient records was look at the doctor's complication rate. And so different experts could look at it and say this was his complication was 2% or whatever it was, and that would be it. In this case, they want to go in and look at the very nature of what we want to protect with the physician-patient statutes, and that is the confidential communications between the patient and the doctor, not complication rates. They want to look at what did the patient and the doctor talk about, and that's the most sensitive and that should be the most protected part of the information. And so if we walk this down the road, Your Honor, what we're going to get is the plaintiffs will have these 200 patient medical records and pull some out. And then when we get to trial, are we going to pull these non-patient party records out and put them on the screen and show them and say, well, in this case, doctor, you said this to the patient. And is Dr. Thamer thinking to get up and talk about the specific patient records that the plaintiffs pulled out? And what if they suggest one of the records says that in this record, it doesn't look like maybe you've provided full informed consent to the patient. Could Dr. Thamer call the patient on the phone and say, hey, do you remember, did I provide you informed consent? So when we open up these records in the way the plaintiff wants to do, I'm not sure what actually they're going to do with them. Because again, in WIF, it was a simple issue. What's the complication rate? Here, they want to look through these records, delve into the personal communications of the patient and his physician, and then say, hey, it looks like from this record you didn't do X or you didn't do Y. And then doesn't Dr. Thamer then get to respond? And so I think we're just opening up a big bag of worms in this particular case, particularly where it doesn't go to an essential issue of the case.
I assume what your opponents are going to say is that his credibility is an essential issue. But of course, you could make that argument in almost every case. Do you have a response to that?
My response would be this, Your Honor. The plaintiff's going to take the stand based on the testimony they've already given in this case. The plaintiff's going to take the stand and say, Dr. Thamer promised me that he was going to perform a horizontal incision when he did the surgery. Dr. Thamer's going to take the stand and he's going to say, I don't specifically recall this appointment, but I would never promise a patient a particular incision because there's just too many variables in this type of surgery. It's too major of a surgery and safety is my primary thing. And I have a general conversation with patients about all of these things. And I'm sure that Dr. Thamer will be subject to a lot of cross-examination. You don't remember the conversation, do you, Dr. Thamer? But the plaintiff does specifically remember the conversation. All that's fair game. But okay, so then they pull up out of these 200 patients, they find one where maybe Dr. Thamer, I don't know this to be true. I haven't looked at the 200 patient records, but maybe there's one in there where Dr. Thamer forgot to write, I discussed the risks with the patient and the patient agrees to proceed, which is essentially what he did in this case. And they pulled up and go, look, you didn't tell this patient. So, I mean, I don't know how that's going to be used, but now we got a patient's record in front of the jury. In fairness, should Dr. Thamer be able to call this patient and say, did he describe to you what the surgery was about? I'm not sure how this is going to affect credibility unless we start trying every surgical case that Dr. Thamer has ever had. There's plenty of tools for the plaintiffs to use to test Dr. Thamer's credibility on cross-examination. And I'm sure they will use those. And
isn't this the point of discovery? To allow a plaintiff to, in a very controlled way, under the rules that we've set out in WIF, have access to these records? I mean, isn't obviously the trial court has the authority to ensure that all identifying information is removed, but isn't that the point of discovery, to lead to potentially relevant evidence? And certainly you have to acknowledge that our decision in WIF is not an outlier. Certainly the majority of courts in the country have held along these lines. South Dakota may be unique in that there is no patient rights a statute or medical protection statute in place, but isn't that also a question for the legislature? Your time's probably expired. If it has, I don't have the clock up here. Perhaps you can get to these questions in your final argument.
He's got 40 seconds.
And I can't see the clock, but that's a great question, Your Honor, because it's in my outline next. But yes, the purpose of discovery is to discover evidence that will, or discover things that will lead to the discovery of admissible evidence. But part of my argument here is what they're looking for, what they're asking for, they haven't told us how that will lead to the discovery of admissible evidence. And in doing so, what they have done is opened up these records, which I understand in WIF, they said, well, once there's redactions made, it's no longer a patient. But I think what I'm asking the court to do is recognize that there has to be some protection for this, even when they're redacted, because there's no way you can eliminate all identifying information in a record. And if you laid down my medical records in front of somebody, they would be able to tell you, regardless of what you redacted, that it was me, if they knew me. And I think that's going to be true of a lot of people. And I'll respond to the rest, Your Honor, in my rebuttal, because I do have an argument on that too.
Your time has expired also.
Thank you.
Mr. Trzynski, you have 20 minutes, sir.
I don't think he knows he's muted.
You're muted, Mr. Trzynski.
Thank you, Justice Gilbertson. I just noticed that I had forgotten to click it off.
Okay, well, you didn't lose any time, so go ahead.
Yeah. May it please the court, counsel. I think Justice Kern really addressed the central issue of this case, is that the whole point of discovering is testing the claims and defenses of both of the parties. In fact, that's explicitly laid out in Rule 26B1, where it says that discovery can essentially be had on any item that is either relevant itself or could lead to the discovery or is reasonably calculated to lead to the discovery of admissible evidence. And that applies not just to the single end argument in the case or the ultimate issue in the case, but it applies to, under 26B1, any claim or defense of either party. Here, the defense, the primary defense of the defendant, is that I didn't act negligently because I do what I always do. That's the primary defense. So if that's his defense, the plaintiff, at a minimum, should be able to obtain discovery on what his general practice is. And what the defendant in this case is asking this court to do is to turn the rules of discovery on its head, where a party can assert a defense and then say, you just have to take my word at it, and you can't do any discovery on that defense. That's not...
Mr. Trzynski, Mr. Haig makes a point, and his argument, as I understand it, is if we allow discovery in this case, we're going to open it up to essentially every case because, and I think it's true from what I've seen as well, every doctor is going to say in a deposition, well, if it isn't my notes, this is what I always do. This is my standard practice. This is my procedure. And in fact, I'm looking at what the trial court said and allowing the discovery and said here, the defendant has no specific recollection of his discussion or assessment of plaintiffs and relies on his general practice. And that's, I don't know that you're ever going to have a medical malpractice case where you won't have that. So are we opening up discovery to essentially every time there's a medical malpractice case and a doctor says, my general practice is to do this, that plaintiffs get to delve into the patient records?
Not necessarily. Sorry, I apologize. Did someone else speak?
No.
Okay. Well, Justice Jensen, that is I have two responses to that. Number one, that is a classic decision for the trial court to make, which is why these sorts of decisions are evaluated under the abuse of discretion standard. In this case, the trial court found, and if we look at page 457 of the settled record, is that the court's finding that, quote, the information sought is relevant because defendant has no specific recollection of his discussions or assessments with plaintiffs and relies entirely on what defendant considers to be his general practice. Additionally, there's an additional layer to this. It's not just that he asserted his general practice, but he actually went so far as to make the claim that he doesn't have issues with informed consent because he makes the decision whether or not to operate on someone using this transverse incision or vertical incision while the patient is actually unconscious. And so he makes that decision at that time. And one of the assertions that the defendant has made in this case is that his general practice is based on safety and is evaluated in part on someone's BMI. Now, if you look at page 97 of the settled record, he indicates that plaintiff, because of her high BMI and abdominal fat, was not a good candidate for a transverse incision because of increased surgery time, increased likelihood of postoperative numbness, and increased risk of postoperative wound complications. That's the basis for his claim. However, by the time that Alyssa had her initial consult and the time of the actual surgery, she had lost weight. So if that were truly the claim, or if that were truly the issue, that he makes the decision based on BMI that he looks at the time of surgery, that was something he could have discussed with Alyssa at that first meeting. Instead, he noted in his records that Alyssa wanted the transverse decision. He didn't make any note that her BMI made her a poor candidate for it. He didn't note in his records that because of her BMI, he told her that she wasn't a good candidate for it. Instead, he simply wrote down that she wanted this horizontal incision.
Mr. Trzinka, so based on the point you just made, it appears you're focusing on his decision during the operation as to how he's going to perform the procedure based on what he says is his practice to determine the safety when he's operating. But the request here and the records actually ordered to be produced, unlike WIP, which just dealt with operative notes and post-operative notes and the actual actions of the doctor. Here, the request was broader than that, and it included the consult notes and the preoperative notes, and those are the types of notes that include a patient's entire medical history. So, you know, where I'm going here, and if you look at this, on, as you suggest, on the facts of a specific case and what is being requested, do you think that's a fair distinction in terms of what you're actually asking for here?
Well, and I think the issue of what constitutes protected health information, as it's called under the HIPAA statute, which is the applicable federal statute on this same matter. Let me talk about it first by looking at what this court described in WIF, and that's at paragraphs 8 and 9. And that it indicates that where the personal identifying information is removed from those records, the privilege no longer applies. And that's because that identifying information, once that's removed, it doesn't matter if it's one patient or another. The records are sufficiently anonymous that there's no identifiable patient there. Now, Mr. Haig made the argument that obviously you're going to be able to identify which patient it is. Well, the defendant hasn't provided any evidence or any studies or any information other than pure conjecture that patients can be identified through these records.
Isn't that really just common sense? I mean, I'm from Sisseton. It's a population of 2,000 people. Everybody in town knows who's going through medical procedures in a town that size. Maybe in Sioux Falls, your argument would hold water, but how about all the rural towns in South Dakota?
Well, and that is an issue that we have to address. That's something that trial courts have to address by making the balancing between when information can be identified and when it can't be identified. Here, we're looking at 300 records out of a city of 200,000 people, and with hospitals that serve several hundred thousand more people in the surrounding areas. So we're looking at a fraction of a percent of people that are here. So the risk of identifying patients based on these records is extraordinarily low, I would contend.
Mr. Haig mentioned something that has been troubling me in this case, and that's leading to admissible evidence. How would the records of non-party patients, how would that be admissible? How would it potentially be admissible in court?
Certainly. Well, let's the easiest example is to look at the BMI exam. So when you look at other patients that have a similar BMI to Alyssa, if those records, if he did horizontal incisions on all of those patients or some of those patients or even any of those patients, it shows that his general practice for these high BMI patients or these relatively high BMI patients, his general practice is not to always do that vertical incision. And so that goes to the very heart of his defense, that he makes the decision while the patient is unconscious. I mean, that's a real concern for informed consent.
All right, but how would you get it into evidence?
You would submit it into evidence as because the doctor would be able to authenticate it himself. Dr. Thamert was the doctor in those cases. And you would talk to him and say, you performed this surgery, correct? This patient had this BMI, which was greater than Alyssa's. That's how the foundation would be laid through Dr. Thamert himself.
Well, but that's impeachment evidence, isn't it? I mean, in terms of your theory of implied consent, informed consent, that issue relates to, okay, as I understand it, your theory is plaintiff said, this is the way I want my incision done. Doctor said, I can do it if it's safe, or there's notes to that effect, and then makes a decision not to, and whether that was appropriate and whether that was within the scope of the consent is the question. How do other patients, the substance of that theory, how do other patients' records relate to that?
Well,
other than impeachment.
And here's where I think we can call anything, any factual issue, impeachment if we call it impeachment. Because any claim or defense, I mean, and it doesn't matter if it's impeachment, I think is the ultimate answer, because under 26B1, it addresses or it looks at those other patient medical records, address the claim or defense of the defendant, which says that you can, which in his defense is that for these BMI cases, I always do vertical incisions. Well, then we get to look at the discovery of whether or not he actually does that. And sure, it may be impeachment, but it's also both discoverable under Rule 26B1, but it's furthermore admissible and relevant under the standards that have been laid out. As Justice Severson laid out in his concurrence in State v. Birdshead, which is 2015 SD 77, he says relevancy is, quote, having any tendency to make the existence of any fact that is of consequence to the determination of the action more probable or less probable than it would be without the evidence. The evidence in these non-patient medical records fits that exact pattern. It makes it more probable or less probable that he does these surgeries using that pattern. Likewise, and this is a liberal standard in terms of relevancy, as Justice as Justice Salter recently pointed out in February, where he indicated that, quote, Rule 401 provides a lenient standard for relevance under which evidence need not conclusively prove the ultimate fact and issue, but only have a tendency to make the existence of any fact that is of consequence more probable or less probable than it would be without the evidence, unquote. That's paragraph 21 at 2020 SD9. And here, what is the fact of consequence that is at issue in this case? How does Dr. Thamert perform, what kind of incision does Dr. Thamert perform on relatively high BMI patients for these anterior approach surgeries? What does he do?
So Mr. Chizinka, let's go back to the other reason. So it seems like you're offering two here, and one is to show that his actual operative practice is different than what he claims it to generally be. And then the other one is what he discusses with the patient before surgery. And that one, you know, we're talking directly about communications there with the patient. And his, as I understand it, he says, that's what I generally tell people. And as in this case, that's not documented in the informed consent note or in the pre-op note. So he's not, how would the discovery of those types of records from the patients and if specifically lead to something that could be admitted as evidence if his practice is, I don't document that, that's just part of my general discussion. So it's not anticipated to be in those records, is it?
That's the interesting part of that, Justice Devaney, is that he says, I never put these things in my medical records. However, in Alyssa Ferguson's medical record, in her initial consult, it features prominently that she requested one of these horizontal incisions. And so we know, based on Alyssa Ferguson's record, that he documents, that he has documented when patients request a specific type of incision.
But that's not what you're, you know, alleging is his problem here. That's what then he then represents to the patient, which is I'd never guarantee that. And I don't see where you've pointed to anything that suggests he indicates, and I document that in my records.
Well, and one of the ways that we can test that theory actually is not necessarily what he writes down, but if the patient requests a horizontal incision and then he performs the horizontal incision, that indicates that he was willing to satisfy that patient's request. If his habit is to perform a vertical incision, then you look and you see, and they're all vertical incisions. Now, he has indicated in his testimony that he's performed horizontal incisions, and we can test to see whether or not he has performed those horizontal incisions after the patient has specifically requested a horizontal incision. And so that's another way in which the evidence can be tested. And so, again, I want to reiterate to this court that these are all discovery issue questions. They're typically the gatekeeping function of the trial court. It isn't for appellate courts to make these decisions. Typically, it's trial courts who make these decisions, and only if those decisions constitute an abuse of discretion does the trial court reverse.
I mean, Mr. Chudzinski, I want to refer you to footnote 2 in WIF. I don't know if you have it up in front of you, but
I do, Jim.
In that opinion, the court says the record sought in this case would not be discoverable in many malpractice cases because they would not be relevant. That seems to be a little bit different standard than scope of discovery standard. Is there perhaps a suggestion in that footnote? Do you think that we're going to look at this a little bit different in a medical malpractice context and patient privilege context than what we will in your normal realm of discovery where you don't have those kinds of issues?
Well, I don't necessarily think that it, and here's the reason why it may not be relevant. I mean, there are circumstances where I would agree that non-patient records would absolutely not be relevant. But that's not the case here. Like in WIF, Dr. Thamer put his practice as the central defense, is only defense in this case, really.
You have 2 minutes.
And then, you know, that is why they're relevant in this case, is because they were the central aspect of his shotgun approach. You know, what this court can say is if the doctor or any of his witnesses has inserted his general practice as the essential element of the case or as his essential defense of the case, then you can look into that general practice. That's not going to be the issue in most of these cases. Here it is. That's the only defense that he has. And let's not lose sight of the fact, and there's this idea of this parade of horribles on this slippery slope that patients will lose confidence if we allow these records to be out there. Well, why don't we have studies then from all of the jurisdictions that are listed in the WIF decision where these records are permitted? Where is the erosion of patient confidence in all of those states? The defendant doesn't cite a single instance where that's the case. It's just conjecture. There's no evidence to back it. And I also want to make sure that the court is highlighted another fact, that the surgical tech, and I'm throwing this in because I'm running out of time, the surgical tech at the day of the surgery told what Dr. Thamer was actually thinking at the time of the surgery. It wasn't that he thought that her BMI was too high. He just couldn't remember if this was the horizontal or the vertical case that he had that morning. That's what the independent witness testimony is. He just forgot.
Hey, thank you, counsel. Your time has expired. Mr. Hay, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I could just respond to the very last statement, the surgical tech did not say he just forgot. The surgical tech actually, this is really not even relevant to this issue, but so you don't think Dr. Thamer is a total bad doctor. What the surgical tech said was that when he left the room, Dr. Thamer had said, I think there's a horizontal incision case this morning, and that they were looking for the record to see if this patient was in fact that patient when he left the room. And we can only assume that he went ahead and found the record, but nonetheless, I didn't want that to go unresponded to. But let me, I think Justice Kern's last question before Mr. Trzanka spoke kind of dovetails into my whole rebuttal. And so in response to her question, isn't this the purpose of discovery? I would say, yes, the standard of discovery is it something that will lead to the discovery of admissible evidence. But that doesn't mean everything is discoverable. And there must be some weighing, both under the physician-patient privilege and under Rule 26, there has to be some weighing of what is discoverable. Not everything in the world is discoverable.
And isn't that the trial court's obligation to determine the scope of the discovery requests and to
absolutely, weigh those Your factors? Honor. Absolutely. But what I'm asking this court to do, Your Honor, is to give the trial court some more guidance in terms of whether we're going to provide any protection to these records. And clearly what I'm in front of this court asking is that you recognize that non-patient medical records deserve some protection. And it's up to the court to decide what that protection is. And if it's nothing, then I guess it's nothing, and we'll know as we go forward. But my argument to this court is there has to be some protection. We can't just release these medical records in every case. And believe me, this particular case is probably one of the lower bars in terms of what's discoverable. Because again, if every time a doctor says, I don't remember the specific appointment, but my standard practice would be X. If every time he says that, you get to see his last 3 years of patients, we're saying that patient records are worth nothing, that the confidentiality is worth nothing, that that communication that patients think that they're getting when they're talking to their doctors is worth nothing. And that's what I'm here arguing for, is that we have to give it some protection.
Mr. Haig, can you respond to Mr. Trzinka's suggestion? I asked you what your standard that you're suggesting would be, and you said the essential element test. He argues that the doctor here inserted his general practice, and also not just the informed consent, but the surgical practice of how he makes these determinations as an essential element here. What is your response to that?
Well, I believe that, one, they're looking for credibility, and two, that the doctor's credibility is not an essential element, and what he does with regard to other patients is not an essential element of the case. Under Rule 406 is the custom and practice statute, which says that you can rely upon custom and practice. And that's what Dr. Thamer's doing. He's telling you, this is my custom and practice. Again, I go back to, Your Honor, one, this is the lowest of the low. So I again, if every time a doctor says, this is my practice, that's an essential element and that's discoverable. Every case now, you're going to have to release non-patient records. I would go back to some of the cases cited in WIF, and this is in further response to Justice Kern as well. Those offer some guidance as well as to what cases would be practical for releasing non-patient records. I believe one of the cases, for instance, was the defense by the doctor was, I couldn't go treat this patient in the emergency room because I had another patient who was a severe burn victim. And so the court said, okay, we're going to release these burn victim records because the doctor's used as his own defense, I couldn't get to one patient because I was treating another more severe patient. That's one record. The weighing there is much different than it is here. Another case that's cited in WIF, which is the burn case, was the Bennett v. Pfizer. The Staley v. Utah Healthcare case, there was a claim for inadequate staffing on the floor. And so there was a limited number of records, names of patients who were on the floor, so they could determine what their conditions were and whether they had staffed the hospital to take care of these patients. Those are things where I can see that the weighing of giving non-patient information would be practical. In this case,
Mr. Haig, do you know, are those cases where the trial court made that weighing decision and the appellate court just affirmed, or were those cases where the appellate court was doing that weighing? And is that appropriate, as Mr. Trzinski says, that we should be weighing as appellate courts, scope of discovery, relevance, those kinds of things?
I don't recall in that case which way the trial court went versus whether the appellate court went back and weighed for it. I'm not discounting the court's ability to weigh these types of issues. And I think it's a necessity that the trial court does have some discretion to weigh these. What I'm asking this court to do is to recognize the medical records need some protection, and to set a standard beyond what WIF sets. Because if you read WIF to its core, what WIF actually says is, once you redact the records, they're no longer entitled to any sort of patient-physician protection. And I'm not sure if that's what the court actually meant by when they released WIF, but I would urge the court to adopt a standard, and I think it needs to be a more stringent standard, because, again, I think, regardless of whether there's a study out there or not, I think the public needs to know that when they're talking to their doctor, that it's not going to be released. And if when I'm talking to my doctor, I know, hey, this might be released, but my name will be crossed off, that's not going to give me a whole lot of solace. Because again, I think that in most cases, in Sisseton and, you know, Pierre and I, you know, Sioux Falls, I think as well. I mean, Sioux Falls is still not a huge community. When you start to release 200 patient records, you're going to have patients that are identifiable by their circumstances. But I would like, and to quickly respond to Mr. Trzinka's argument, because again, one of my frustrations, and maybe I'm just thick-skulled, but one of my frustrations is the plaintiffs still haven't told us what they're going to do with these records. Okay, we're going to turn over hundreds and hundreds of pages of records, redacted. What are they going to do with them? And one of the things, they give us general things, but if you look down the road, I'm not sure how this leads to the discovery of admissible evidence. And one of the things Mr. Trzinka brought up was, you know, we might find a patient who had a BMI, and we could see what Dr. Thamert did with regard to this other patient who had a similar BMI. Well, Dr. Thamert's testified that the BMI is really not what determines what the safest type of incision is. BMI is a total body fat type of thing. This has all been part of this case. And people can have large BMIs and not have much fat on their abdomen, which is the critical place where you want to decide what's the best type of incision. Or patients can have low BMIs and still have significant amount of fat on their abdomens. So again, even if he pulls out one of these records and says, look, this is a patient with a similar BMI and you were able to do a vertical incision, Dr. Thamert's got to be able to defend himself. And so the plaintiffs say, well, we need to check his credibility. If Dr. Thamert says, well, I remember that patient. She did have a similar BMI, but it wasn't in her abdomen. Now we have another credibility test. Then can he call this patient so the jury can see what the patient looks like? I'm still not seeing where he's going to use these records. And it just seems to me it's not a road that the state wants to go down in terms of putting non-patient records on a board and having the jury look at what happened with other people. I guess in conclusion, I would say this, when I'm repeating myself and forgive me, but again, if we let the records out in this case, I think they're going to come out in every case. Because again, it's very common. Doctors, when they, you know, they have 2 years to sue them, they don't always remember what was said. They don't always remember exactly what they did, but it's very typical. It's, I mean, almost all cases, at some point the doctor says, I don't specifically remember, but my standard practice is X. And if that's going to be the standard, everything, it's going to be a free-for-all for non-patient records. And so we would ask the court to adopt a standard that would make it an essential element raised by the defendant. And we would ask the court to reverse the trial court's order, ordering Dr. Thamert to turn over these 200 some non-patient records.
Okay, thank you, counsel. This completes the formal part of our argument, but I'd just like to visit with counsel for a second. This is the first time that this court has held oral arguments through a Zoom or anything close to it. And I just am interested in your reactions as counsel. All three of you are up here with some frequency as to what you think of the process. Obviously, we didn't have a choice with the COVID-19, but it's out there for the future. Mr. Hay, what do you think of it?
I thought it worked really well. I really loved being in the Supreme Court room, but as a second choice, this worked out well, I thought.
Mr. Trzinka, what do you think?
Well, Justice Gilbertson, I would love to have been able to argue with you folks in person just from a personal standpoint of being in the room. But my own, I think, biases as a former software developer may interfere with that. And I like this process. I'm very comfortable in front of a computer. I'm probably in a lot of times more comfortable in front of a computer than in front of certain people. But I'm comfortable with this. I think it's a good way, especially in a rural state that's very sort of spread out, for people to have access to the courts, and it helps for attorneys also when, you know, there are issues where we get blizzards a lot, you know, and if there's a blizzard where not everybody can attend a Supreme Court hearing, it doesn't necessarily mean that the hearing is canceled and everything is put out of the way. We can just reschedule or reconfigure it to a platform that's convenient for all the parties. And so I think that it's a good thing. I think that being able to leverage the technology that we have is good, especially in a rural state. It will give us the opportunity to be a leader, I think, in some of these ways.
Hey, Mr. Brantrow, what do you think?
Justice, I'm glad that my law partner mentioned that he has a background in technology, because he was the one that forgot to unmute himself. I concur. I heard you ask this to the first panel, and I've been contemplating it for the last 2 hours, and there's just something special about being in the courtroom with the five of you that I don't think can be replicated via this this pattern, this method. It is, you know, functionally a suitable replacement because we're all communicating, you know, with each other. But I think being able to address you guys in person is there's just something special that's missing when we do it this way. And so my preference would be not to continue to do it this way unless we absolutely need to. And hopefully this never happens again. But that's my two cents.
Hey, well, thank you, counsel. Your opinions are welcome and appreciated. I will remind the court that we will conference at 12:30 via the telephone. And with that, we are in recess, and thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.